You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
What does it mean to exist as a human being? Are some people more human than others by virtue of their capabilities, because of their standing within this family rather than that family, on account of their chosenness by this God or that God? Such questions trouble philosophers periodically, and that's why Christian Humanist Profiles is pleased to welcome Dr. H.G. Wright, whose recent book Ontic Ethics proposes a new focus on relationships both between you and me and between past and present and future that should give us some interesting questions to bring to the world. Dr. Wright, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
It's a pleasure.
Well, your introduction promises an ontology that will serve as a vehicle for bringing reason back to morals. For our listeners who took their introduction to philosophy class a while ago, talk to us for a little bit about the philosophical practices that we call ontology and ethics, and say just a little bit about why your approach brings these two together, when some approaches to philosophy don't make them as closely related.
Well, I'm going to grossly generalize here about these, and ethics is the easier one. Ethics is part of what we call value theory, and that includes ethics, which is about how we treat ourselves and other people and our environments, animals, etc. Whereas aesthetics, the other branch of value theory, is more about what satisfies our senses or how we should or can appreciate the things in our environment. And you can see that they're related because obviously the degree to which you appreciate something is going to affect the way you treat that thing. And ethics itself is usually, not always, but usually divided into three parts. And it's about what it is good to want as an end. So that part of ethics is usually called consequentialism. What's right to do, which is about the do's and the don'ts. So that would be like something like the Ten Commandments, guidelines for action, the right actions. And then there's a part of ethics that's about virtues of character. And what I want to get across here to the audience is that my book really focuses on character, virtues of character, and traits of character, and how they relate really to the intensity of our existence as humans and as people. And that's where ontology comes into it. And this is a little more abstract, but ontology is the field, many of you may remember, that studies being, and that sounds awfully general, it studies existence or being, and it pretends, at least, claims to be something more than just physics. Now, there are people who, certainly in our scientific culture, say that all there is what physics describes. But ontology has approaches to some of the mysteries that really, I think, transcend physics. And I'll just give a couple of those to give an idea to the audience of what ontology covers. One is about being and non-being, and this is very important because I think, as opposed to a lot of people, that things don't just exist or are non-existent. I think things, and especially what we're going to talk about today, persons, exist more or less. Another part of ontology is the discussion of this problem called the one and the many, the unity problem. And I think most listeners have wondered, probably once in a while, how is it that all these different neurons in my brain and all these different thoughts and so forth unify themselves into one consciousness? And this is the old problem also related to the problem of change and persistence. How is it the same hammer if I change the head three times and the handle three times? So how, in my book, what counts here is about how do we persist as persons through our lives and through all the changes that are in our lives. I hope that gives a general idea. And I guess what I want to say about differences from other forms of philosophy would be that I'm trying to link our actions to our characters very tightly. And there are approaches which really don't. One is called intuitionism, where we're just supposed to know without reasoning what's right and wrong. One is called instrumentalism, which is mostly about figuring out how to do things and get what we want, but doesn't really discuss our goals. And then there are ethics that are embedded in cultures and customs. And finally, very important in philosophy is Kantianism, which really says that reason prescribes rules called maxims, and that these are self-evident, and so that we should, in order to behave ethically, we have to adhere to these rules.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say those are the various ideas that my book is sort of bouncing off of, having a dialogue with, springing from.
All right. Well, I want to follow up on the idea of virtue ethics just a little bit. One of the promises or one of the projects of this book is to search for a cross-cultural virtue ethics. The implicit criticism there is that previous versions of virtue ethics tend to be more provincial than universal. Why is this pursuit of a cross-cultural project important as we go forward?
Well, I think the biggest reason right now that I could point out is terrorism and war and violence and coercion. If we don't have some sort of ethical standard that transcends our cultures and our customs, then finally, when we come to disputes, our only methods of resolution involve some sort of intimidation or coercion or violence. And we are having, at the moment, clashes of cultures, even clashes within Western cultures of our subcultures. So other practices that have based ethics on, let's say, faith alone clash with each other because there are more than one faith, even within Christianity, as well as you well know and your mm-hmm. readers well know. The ones that base it on custom and practice fail to settle disputes. And then this intuitionism that I mentioned turns out not to be universal. It turns out that the intuitions we have in one culture aren't the same intuitions that people have in another, for instance, in India versus California. Mm-hmm. And then there's something called the ethics of authenticity, which is associated with Charles Taylor, a very great modern philosopher, but also with Abraham Maslow, a psychotherapist. And the problem there that I see is that there are lots of kinds of authentic. So just being authentic doesn't mean you're good. You could be an authentic sadist or misanthrope or safecracker or kleptomaniac, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm really doing is trying to say that virtues are tightly linked to ontology, and there is a primary virtue, which is the virtue of love and care and compassion, and that if we see the lens through that virtue, we're going to be able to transcend some of these differences, cultural mm-hmm. and otherwise.
Well, another one of those difficulties that arises within virtue ethics is that even when you identify love or relationality as sort of the high mark, we tend to disagree about what counts as love, what counts as the benefit of the neighbor, those sorts of things. And you grant this in your book, which is one of the strengths of the book, but talk to us a little bit, how can virtue ethics work when the telos at which we aim, that perfection that, you know, defines good action and bad action and neutral action, when that's a moving target, how can we do ethics?
Well, I have to say that this is very difficult, and that both as a person and as a writer, I've wrestled with this, and I don't think we're going to come up with a prescription for some sort of definite solution for each sort of dilemma that we get into. But part of the problem has to do with notions of perfection. We used to, well, deriving from Aristotle, there was this idea that each thing had a perfection of its kind. And so a pair of scissors was supposed to be perfect or not perfect, depending on the design and how it worked. But we know that even for scissors, there are different kinds, and some are perfect for one use and some are perfect for another use. And Aristotle thought that there were perfections for humans and other natural kinds, such as trees. And what we should do in order to be moral would be aim at the perfection of those things. But if we say that those perfections are multiple, and there are contradictory perfections, for instance, there might be oak trees that had a very strong resistance to diseases, and there might be others that produced the best acorns for survival with the most genetic variety. How are we going to say what a perfect oak tree is, both intrinsically within itself or extrinsically for lumber or shade? We are dealing with moving targets there. And that's why, actually, in my book, what I talk about is our relation to the whole, to sort of the ensemble of all the things that we come in contact with. And I think we have to aim at the flourishing of our worlds, the worlds that interact with us, not have rigid ideas about what the flourishing of any one object is. Mm-hmm. Those objects are all particular, and people are particular. So we have people who flourish in different ways. And I think in order to exercise the virtue of charity or compassion or love, we have to aim at flourishing, but we can't have an exact idea of what the flourishing of an object or a person is. We have to enter into a dialogue and a relationship with that object or person.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that gets at that question.
Oh, I think it does, and I think what's beneficial about that is that on one hand, you know, what you've been saying pretty clearly, this is not something that we can establish before we begin existing alongside the other person, you know, and trying to do what is good for them, to be loving towards them. But on the other hand, I think that, you know, with that kind of framework in place, we still have the capacity to say that action, even if you say that it's for their benefit, is not, and here are reasons why it's not. And it strikes me that, you know, though that Scylla and Charybdis pair often trouble people who are trying to do ethics. I mean, is that something that you see going on in moral philosophy?
Where there's a conflict, you mean like some sort of dilemma about what is beneficial or not beneficial in a relationship?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, just to give an example from, you know, the history of philosophy, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals would say that, you know, what is good is for the strong to exert their strength and to extend their power in the world. And he says that, you know, people who say that, you know, the strong should be doing things to benefit the weak have it entirely wrong. And I think that this approach, you know, doesn't simply leave it as, well, whichever of those you prefer is fine. I mean, it still wants to say,
oh, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because I think that the meaning of the world to the person who's interacting with the world has to do with how they value that world.
There we
and
go.
I actually have a chapter on Nietzsche where I talk about, I mean, I think he's an amazing philosopher and he's a wonderful writer.
Mm-hmm.
But as he evolved, he got to be more and more single-minded about reducing all of our motives to the acquisition and the use of power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that left him not valuing a lot that was in his world and actually diminished his relationship with his world, even though he was a wonderful writer, a very lively writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Well, I want to turn from the idea of virtue ethics to ontology, which is, you know, where your argument goes next. And I got the sense as your book went along that ontology as a philosophical project is at least in part the destruction of stupid binaries. You know, whether we're talking about mind and body, whether we're talking about, you know, free will and disposition, all of these sorts of things, I mean, I think that you address through this practice of ontology. So talk a little bit about the roots of the fact-value binary to get us started, and talk to us about how a strong ontology breaks up that pair.
Well, after the Enlightenment, I think that the worldview of science became, you might say, uppermost in at least a lot of intellectual circles. And we started to think that there were facts about the world which we could discover with science, but that there weren't really any facts about our values. And so we became disconnected. We couldn't use our reason to decide what we should value, and there was a lot of temptation to be relativist and to be arbitrary and to say whatever you like, go it goes. And this actually, there's quite a history to this, and there are a lot of cross currents. But going back to David Hume, there are actually two opposite lessons that can be drawn from Hume. Initially, in his first part of his famous book, The Treatise, he seems to think that once we try to establish facts, incontrovertible facts about everything, we end up not knowing anything. And then in the second part of his book, he brings emotion into it and says, oh, but wait a minute, our emotions are informative to us. And starting right there, and with Kant later on, who said we should be able to reason about morals, and then people found that they really couldn't reason the way Kant expected. Ethics took a turn, and it ended up around the turn of the 20th century, 19th to 20th century, with G.E. Moore saying, well, there's something called the good, but you can't say why it's good, because it's the only good thing. There's nothing else good that makes it good. So it was kind of like a bootstraps situation where all you had was your opinion. And if you thought it was good, then it was good. And G.E. Moore thought his intuitions about what was good would be universal, but it turned out they weren't, as I already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So following that, my friend Mark Johnson said ethics was set back for 50 years because we didn't think we could say anything rational about values. And I guess that's the dichotomy that I want to try to overcome in my book. And I want to say, this is the way I get into it. I say, okay, there are facts, science studies, there are values that we have, but there are facts about people who hold values.
Mm-hmm.
And the values they hold affect their existence, factual existence. And so that's how I think ontology and ethics can come together.
Mm-hmm. And in that pursuit, I mean, one of the thinkers that you interact with is Charles Taylor, who you already mentioned. He argues, according to your account, that instrumental rationalism, which you mentioned earlier, you know, the state of mind where reason only applies to how we get what we want, that there
right.
is no reasoning about, you know, what's better to want and what's worse to want. He argues that does some real damage to the self. So what happens to the self when we separate emotions and values that way?
Well, I think, first of all, I think Taylor was answering to this notion that came from the Enlightenment. Maybe it isn't totally fair to all the Enlightenment authors, of an atomic self, that somehow mm-hmm. the self was separated, and there's something called self-interest that only has to do with the self and doesn't have to do with relationships with others, and so therefore all of the ethical precepts are conditional. They're all if-then things. So if you want such and such, then you have to do these things. And that's called pragmatics nowadays. I think Taylor felt that when there was such an isolated self that the world could become very easily meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
To people who held that notion. And so it was hard for them. It would be hard to stick to any particular set of values. There wouldn't be any particular reason. to keep your values, you could change them tomorrow. Because all of the focus was on this narrow self, this atomic self. I think Taylor's book, I mean, is a very good book, a readable philosophy book, which is a rare item. would be a good thing for just about anyone to read. And I was trying to use it as a springboard for some of the things I was writing about. I really think he thinks that this instrumental attitude devalues other things, devalues the other, and puts the focus on strategy, tactics, and not on ends.
And I think one of the telling signs of that is that we start to import language from the realm of economics, which is a, you know, very mathematical, rationalist discourse, into matters of love and value. And I mean, one of the discussions in your book that I especially, I almost said especially valued, but I almost fell into that trap, didn't I? But the notion of fungibility in love and value. What does that economic term fungibility mean when we bring it to bear on questions of ethics, and when we treat ethical philosophies, or when we treat values as fungible in ethical philosophy, what do we miss about desire?
Right. Well, the notion is actually simpler than the word. It's the idea that you can reduce qualities to quantities. And so the most famous person who invented something called the hedonic calculus, Jeremy Bentham, thought that we could tote up our attractions and our repulsions toward things, and we could decide what gave us the most pleasure, and that would be the thing that motivated us to act. And John Stuart Mill tried to sort of modify this and say, well, okay, but you still have some sort of obligation to others. And I'm not sure he was able to take that theory, which is called utilitarianism, and really turn it into something that was altruistic. But the notion there is that preferences, you can calculate preferences and tote them up and predict what people will do. And another sort of fungibility has to do with affections, like our liking and our disliking for other people, our loving and our caring. And that would be kind of, sounds kind of crass when you start thinking about, well, this person is worth $20 worth of affection and this person is worth $100. And oh, I just found someone else who fits in my portfolio better than these. I'll throw somebody out because I'm not getting as much out of that relationship. So economic rationality and microeconomics, some of your readers may remember back in college, they showed these consumer satisfaction curves, and they talked a lot about self-interest. And I do think that that just can't apply to our ethical relations in the world. And then I have one other area which I want to mention that has to do with fungibility. That is about causal forces, and it's related to the others, it's related to preferences. But if we think that all the causal forces in the world acting on us, and all the forces within our minds and our bodies acting on us are quantifiable, then it's logical to say that all of our actions are just necessitated, they're just forced and determined by all of those forces. And I don't think, I'm trying to say in this book, that you can't add up our motives that way.
Right, right. And then what's interesting about that is that, again, you know, the whole notion that, you know, you can do this calculus of pleasure, this hedonic calculus, as Bentham called it, assumes things about, I guess, the mathematical regularity of human action that, I mean, in most people's lives just doesn't, you know, bear out.
Yes, I mean, we obviously are full of contradictions. And if you really start looking at people's preferences, they change from moment to moment. And it's actually very hard to try to work with a theory like that when you're talking about people. They change over time. They contradict themselves over time. They have internal conflicts. And it's not that easy to sum up some sort of averaged over motivational state.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about your idea of a person in this book and the account that you give of it. As we talked before we recorded, I heard echoes of Heidegger as you proposed that a person is a self that can reflect on the self and change the self. So to quote your book briefly, you articulate personhood as, quote, a self that evaluates and deliberates on its own nature and identity, close quote. As we move forward into some of the more technical questions of character and liberty in this book, what elements of your definition of personhood, it's a working definition to be sure, stand as most important?
Well, I want to say that that is a fairly standard idea of a person. It's nothing original to my book, but it's very important if we're going to have any kind of liberty to improve ourselves, to change ourselves, to be better people in the world, then we have to be able to distance ourselves from the way we are right now and criticize it. And think about alternatives. Just like I think I compare ethics to learning something like a musical instrument or tennis. If you want to learn to play an instrument, you have to think, okay, I can't play an instrument right now, but I want to be somebody who can play an instrument better, and these are my steps I'm going to do. And so you're being somewhat, you're distancing yourself from your present state, and you're saying, okay, I want to do this. And I think that it's extremely important that we should have values about our values. In other words, we should be a little bit ambivalent in order to be persons. We have to step back and look at ourselves and say, oh, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? Do I like what I'm doing about it? And if we do that, if we're going to be free at all, this being persons of that sort who can sit back and criticize themselves and think of themselves, as Heidegger says, as an issue for themselves, it's just crucial.
Mm-hmm.
So if we didn't have that kind of personhood, we wouldn't get off the ground as far as liberty goes.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, I mean, backtracking a little bit to that utilitarian picture, you know, the working assumption seems to be there is that pleasure is something that doesn't need any reflection. It simply exists. You can total it up. You can add. You can subtract. Whereas, you know, this definition, you know, which, like I said, I mean, seems to have its roots in phenomenology more than in utilitarianism, assumes, I mean, right at the outset that what we value and what pleases us, I mean, for that matter, can and should change, and that if it doesn't, there might be something wrong.
Yes, absolutely. And I think among philosophers, John Dewey was very important in saying that as we engage in things, we change and we reflect on those changes. We reflect on the new influences that are coming to, you know, into our lives. I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the notion of pleasure is way too simplistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly may have thought at one time in my life that drinking a lot of alcohol and then looking into the bottom of a toilet bowl and throwing it up was some kind of pleasure. And after about the second time I did that, I realized it wasn't. And I mean, that's just a simple example of the way we do change. Our notions of pleasure change.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we should base our ethics on that.
Right, right. And I, you know, and really, I mean, you know, the way that you just narrated that, you know, if someone were to provide a counterclaim to that, they might narrate it instead in terms of, you know, letting go of your inhibitions and, you know, doing what impulse leads you to do. So, I mean, even based on the way that
right.
we narrate an evening of heavy drinking, it's going to come across as something that is pleasurable or not pleasurable, even though what a video camera would capture or not capture, one would hope, would be identical.
Yeah, well, you know, proverbs have to be applied in certain situations. And
mm-hmm.
the ones that are really, I mean, there's this saying, just do it.
Yeah.
I think that's a Nike, just do it. Well, that's one thing. And then there's another, say, what is the other one? It's about drugs. Just don't do it or something like that.
Yeah, just say
I think those two things, just say no, right. Those are two opposite proverbs that have their applicability in different situations.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't, that's why I think we can't take rules, absolute rules, across all of the circumstances that we're in.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about this notion of personhood that you lay out, and you grant that, you know, you are, you know, following up on work that other people have done, but you take the next logical step and say that for such an entity as a person, as we talk about a person, when you detach rationality from value and emotion, what you end up with isn't even reason anymore, but something less than reasonable. So
that's right.
Give me an example of that, because I think that's a concept that our listeners could really benefit from.
Well, I don't know if I should tell a story here or just talk about varieties of people.
I'll tell a story.
Let me. There are people who have had injuries to the prefrontal parts of their brains,
mm-hmm.
and they're able to remember things perfectly. They can. Act instrumentally, that is, they can figure out how to do something correctly, but they can't become attached to things, and they really don't function. Their worlds become mm-hmm. flat and meaningless. They can't form lasting attachments. They become socially inept, and they are like computers. I mean, most of you have had to deal with your computer being a dunderhead at times, because it doesn't have emotions. So people like John Dewey and David Hume and others since then have said there's more to reason than just calculation. There is something that goes under the name of the reasonable. That's an important part of our functioning in the world. And if you can be perfectly reasonable, rational.
There you go.
and then be a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I'm saying in my book, is not a very good way of living, and not just good. It's not, it doesn't have the substance to it
mm-hmm.
that a caring sort of living, a kind of rationality that deals with attachments and with goals mm-hmm. would have. And I think the purely reasonable, well, here's an example. Supposing you are working in an emergency room and a baby comes in and the baby dies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, pure rationality and economic rationality would say, stop right there, walk out of the room and go do something else. You can't do anything here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that we can turn on a dime like that, which would be, I would say, the prescription of pure rationality. Say, mm-hmm. okay, go do something else, worthwhile, be efficient. I don't think we can do that and be humans. And I don't think that the next time a baby comes in sick that we can care about it as much if we walk away like
mm-hmm.
that.
Right, right.
So
well, and you know,
some of it has to do with walking away.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm a rhetoric professor by profession, and I just note that, you know, when we deal with rationality and when we deal with reason, I mean, there are different kinds of metaphors built in there. So, you know, rationality is ratios. You divide this by
right.
this, you get a, you know, a mathematical solution. And I think that you're right here to argue that mathematical rationality is always a part of reasoning. But if you take that away from the rest of what we call reasoning, you're right. I mean, you know, you have... honestly, what I think of is, you know, the sort of cold-blooded vigilante character from, you know, a dozen different superhero stories.
Yeah.
It's someone who doesn't care about any given person, but just has a rational idea of these sorts of people need to be removed from the situation.
Right. And there are connections. I guess an example I would give is something
mm-hmm.
like a game. Rigid rationality usually applies to something that is within a practice or a game. So let's say you're playing a game of bridge and mm. there are certain rules and so forth, and you're about to finesse somebody's queen, and someone over in the corner of the room clutches his chest and says, and falls to the floor. Now, it's not within the rules of winning in bridge that you get up from the table and go over there and help that person.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the trouble with narrowed rationality is it always is within an enclosure like that.
Right, right.
And there is always potentially something outside the enclosure that's bigger than whatever the rationality is supposed to apply to.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think you just narrated the short-sightedness of certain forms of economic thought more generally, that it treats human beings as sometimes mostly and sometimes exclusively rational actors who are out to maximize their advantage.
Right, and they, of course, economists see it in terms of consumption. Not all economists, mm-hmm. but...
Right, I said some.
yeah.
Well, I want to go to your sixth chapter because you come back to this question of character and liberty, and it's one of the binaries that your book does such a nice job of breaking up. But you give really two answers to the question of character and liberty, the dilemma where if you do something because of your inherent personal dispositions, it's not really a free action. But on the other hand, if you freely act, then it's hard to give an account for how it relates to who you are as a human being. So I want you to take your time here, melt our brains for a moment here, and tell us about your less radical answer about how character and disposition can link up, and then give us your more radical answer, which really kind of presents a brand new ontology of time.
Well, I guess what I probably should start by saying here is that something about time, because I think we all think of it in terms of clocks as a continuum that can be divided into smaller and smaller parts. And when you think about it, the present is actually an infinitesimally small part of time. Taking it one step further, it doesn't exist at all. There's no room for anything to happen in that little bit of time. Not even an atom can have its electron pattern circulate within an instant. A molecule can't within a longer instant. And so if the present doesn't exist because it's too small to have anything in it, and we think the past doesn't exist because it's already done and the future is not here yet, then nothing exists at all. And we're living in a life of illusion. And actually, one of the ancients, Parmenides, said that, said, mm-hmm. this isn't logical, this whole idea of time. Connected to that is the notion that there's something called the state of the world. And philosophers have talked about this for some years, as though the world was complete or is complete at a present moment, and that there's nothing happening in the past or in the future. It's all complete and there. And if it's all there, then you can predict the evolution of it from this particular state that's static. And I don't believe that. Now, whether I can prove it or convince anybody, I'm not sure. You have to read the book. But I feel like the past is always is somewhat unfinished. And there isn't such a thing as a univocal state of the world. The world is ambivalent at all times. The world is ambiguous. The world is in process. And there are people, process philosophers, Whitehead, who have had this idea, Heraclitus, the ancient, who said you can't step into the same river twice,
mm-hmm.
Was the famous forerunner of this notion. So I honestly think that time is not... that clock time is somewhat deceptive and that phenomenal time spreads out over the past, at least, and probably over some of the future. And so that there's a phenomenal present which involves completing or making something out of the past. And what the past really was depends on what you do now, to some extent. Not mm-hmm. that some of the past isn't congealed and fixed, but that there are things in the past that we won't know what they are until we see what turns out. So I presented in the book two notions of how we could possibly be free and still have our actions connected to our character. Getting back to your question,
mm-hmm.
person who posed that was David Hume, who said, well, either we're determined by our characters and all the circumstances that influence us, and therefore our actions are connected to our characters, or else our actions are not determined, they're just accidental, they're like hiccups, they are not connected to our characters, and so we can't really call that freedom either, because it isn't the action of a character. It's mm-hmm. just an unrelated accident. So now getting into the two ideas that I wanted to present as possibilities, hypotheses, I guess I would call them, and I just want to say again that I feel like thinking that we're free and being free is crucial ethically. The first idea is sort of an extension of something Kant said. Kant had these categories of apperception, notions of ideas about how our minds work and how we have to perceive the world. And he said, well, we don't know what the world is really like, but we just know that our minds have to see it in such and such a way. And one of the ways, the one I want to draw on, is he said, well, we have to think of terms in, we have to think of events in terms of causes and effects. So we have to think that everything in the world is caused.
Mm-hmm.
And the first notion that I put forth in my book is that it's quite possible that we could make one choice and look back into the past and say A, B, C, D, E, F are the causes of this action after the action happened. But that we could have done another thing and then look back into the past and say, oh, actually, it was F, G, H, I, J, a whole different set of causes that led to that action. So that there might be freedom in terms of the act itself, but whatever the action we performed would necessitate a different view of the way causes worked in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first idea that I thought would connect actions to the past of character, but there would be this element of freedom, of free play in the choice between one action and another. I'm not as enamored, I mean, of this idea as I am of the second one, but the second one is, will sound more preposterous to a lot of philosophers. and that is that we actually, the past really isn't finished, and that when we do things, we are acting in a present which extends back over the clock time past. So that all of our, let's say we have, as the people who formulated the hedonic calculus said, we have a certain number of motives, possible motivations for action, that we can choose among. Now, the people who are determinists say those motives are already formed, they already have a certain force, and all of our actions will be the result of the sort of averaging over or combination of all these forces in our character and in our situations. Well, what I'm saying is those motives are not actualized until we act on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that our actions are always modifying our motives. So that actually we are reaching back into the clock time past and creating new parts of our character when we act freely. There's a deceptive term that gets in the way of our thinking about this, the term willpower.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we think that it takes power to exert our wills, then we're going to think it, like Newtonians. We're going to say, okay, there has to be some sort of force that makes us decide to do one thing versus another. And therefore, since there's a force, the decision was forced, and we're not free. What I'm trying to say, I'm trying to separate will from power.
Mm-hmm.
And say will or at least it may be the wrong term, but what gives us free choice, this way that our consciousness combines us, reintegrates us to take a new step, a new action, does not require force. What the choice does is recruits among the possible motivations and actualizes them. So it's not like you can pull an action out of thin air where you had no motive in your character, no motive in your past, but you can select among your motives. You can actualize, you can energize some of them to provide the energy to carry out the choice. So what I try to say in that chapter is, isn't it possible that the choice is free and the energy to carry out the choice comes from the motives that are actualized by the choice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so if I can attempt an example here, you know, I mean, if you think of book one of Homer's Iliad, Achilles, in a moment, you know, has the urge to murder Agamemnon on the spot. By the old theory, he would have to meet his murderous rage with this opposing force called willpower, which gets allegorized as Athena. And because Athena wins out over Orge, or whatever the Greek for rage is there, I don't have the Greek text in front of me, he ends up not murdering Agamemnon. What your account seems to say is that he does have that murderous rage. He also has the motivation before that moment comes to extend an advantage over a longer span of time, and that his freedom is that he allows that motivation, which was already there, to supersede the motivation to murder Agamemnon, which is also already there. Is that a fair example?
It is. It's a very good example. And I think that the element of surprise is really important there, the element of newness. If we were to look at his motives, apart from the action that he took eventually, we might say, wow, he had this overwhelming rage. He should have committed the murder.
Mm-hmm.
But from where he was situated, I think he had the power to activate another response, another set of motives, and to actually create, you might say, the strength to do, you know, to take the other action, not to commit the murder.
Right, right. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about this before. I mean, what I find so appealing about this is that, you know, in terms of, you know, ontological philosophy, you're giving an account here that, you know, Christians should find familiar from, you know, Augustine's Confessions, from other sorts of theological texts that, you know, give you the impression that a person who acts to harm the neighbor isn't a sinner yet, that it only becomes sin when the person becomes aware of the possibility of forgiveness and either receives that forgiveness or doesn't. So, I mean, I think that your radical proposal probably appeals to me simply because, theologically speaking, I would, you know, affirm that, you know, the moment of forgiveness really does render those past actions as sins rather than as some other sort of phenomenon. What do you think about that? I mean, is that a fair connection between your philosophy and a theology of sin and forgiveness?
Well, you know, I'm not absolutely sure that I understand what you're saying, but if an action can arouse forgiveness, or a decision can arouse forgiveness, then it is related to what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But is that what you said? I'm not clear.
Well,
that's about Augustine.
I think that's right. I think what I had in mind more, though, was the idea that for a person to, you know, confess sins and receive forgiveness to sins is at least in part to render one's past not simply actions that are morally neutral but instrumentally advantageous, but to re-narrate it so that they actually ontologically become sins and then sort of, you know, good deeds that were done with prevenient grace, so that the character of your narrative up to that point actually changes because of the act of forgiveness.
I get it now. What you're saying is that this new state of mind of repentance is transformative of the past in the sense that you are now reconceiving it as something different.
And, right.
And it actually, in my mind, isn't just reconceiving. You're actually changing it.
Right. It becomes something different.
The thing that made me, I don't know how I first came up with this, but I thought about people when they die and if things are found out about them afterwards, how that changes our views of their lives, the narrative changes.
Sure.
And I think you don't have to die to have that happen. When you're alive, you can realize what you did, let's say wrongly or rightly, and that realization is going to change the way that action fits in your sort of overall picture of values. And so it is going to transform to some extent. It's not going to erase, but it's going to put it in a different setting, and it's going to permeate that old action, what looked like a past action, and give it a new twist.
Well, very good, very good. Well, I want to turn to your final full chapter, the one before the conclusion. You discuss some matters of public concern, and one of the keys to thinking about public policy within this ontology has to do with the limited scope of human care. So talk to us a little bit about your last chapter. What do we miss, politically speaking, when we neglect that reality of human existence?
Well, I think maybe I can introduce this by talking about narrow caring and wide caring. I think as situated local beings who have certain particular talents, things that we're good at, things that we're close to, and so forth, that we naturally are going to exert care and action on these things that are close, which I would say would be the narrow things. So I think sometimes moralists, well, some of our notions of morality are too demanding. They say, well, we should give equal care to everything because of the idea of equality. But I think that if we diffuse our efforts over everything, we won't be taking care of the things up close that matter the most to us. We won't have the energy that we can bring to bear on things that are closer to us. And in addition, I think only when we become attached to those near and dear things can we appreciate other people becoming attached to things that are near and dear to them. So I guess an example I gave maybe in my book, I'm not sure. I'm a pediatrician, and so I try to care about my patients equally. And yet, I give money for my son's and my grandson's education. Now, I'm not going to divide all that money and give $2 to every child in my practice. I'm going to do it because of motivations that I actually have that I can latch onto that will work with my family. And I think we need to forgive ourselves for being limited, recognize and use our particular talents, recognize that if we try to distribute our caring everywhere, we'll be paralyzed, recognize that by nature we're more motivated to do things for things that are those near and dear to ourselves, but then use that knowledge and those experiences to understand better the needs of others who aren't so closely connected, and you know, make some political decisions that do favor equality more. But I don't think we have to be personally distributing every ounce of our action over the whole populace of the world, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I immediately think of my own students, you know, currently in their late teens or late teens, early 20s. And one of the things that tends to just breed all sorts of anxiety for them is that when they are on, you know, social media, internet social networks, they encounter, I mean, it seems like a dozen posts a day saying, how in the world can you just keep doing what you're doing when this problem exists in the world? Why are you doing nothing about this? And it strikes me that, I mean, this council that, you know, emerges from this ontology lets us focus on the things that we can actually help, the places where we can give real benefit instead of, as you said, spreading ourselves, not even just to the, you know, children that come into your practice, but to every child in every village in all of North Africa.
Right. Well, and, you know, I know everyone, even in the pre-internet age, like the one I live in, mostly, you get all this mail with all these appeals and you would like to give to every charity, but if you did, you wouldn't really do anything for anyone. And it probably is more important to get really interested in something that you have some sort of passion for and focus your interests on that. But it is hard. And the more appeals that come in from the more different directions, and this certainly happens on the web, you know, they're pulling at you. I think it's legitimate to say, no, I can do this. This is what I'm capable of.
All right.
And start with, you know, do something.
Mm-hmm.
But do something that's special for you.
Very good. Well, Gary, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I want you to have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about ethics, choice, time, or anything else as we head towards the door?
Well, the thing I wanted to emphasize is that I think my book is about virtue ethics, but if you really think about most of the virtues, they were exhibited by Hitler's armies and the Japanese army during World War II: courage, loyalty, inventiveness. So that there seems to be an order among virtues. And in my book, the order is what, you can tell me where this comes from, but that quote in this King James Version of one of Paul's letters about now abideth these three, faith, hope, and charity.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest is charity.
That would be 1 Corinthians 13.
Right. Well, I think for me, the greatest virtue is love in all of its forms and affection through the world. And that is the lens through which we can see things in a way that helps us flourish and them flourish in tandem. So I'm trying to say that it is love that makes us ontologically bigger than our narrow selves, and that there's something that I conceived of and talked about as the true self, which is the self that helps the world flourish along with the self. And there isn't a prescription for this because we're all so different and unique. But I just do think for the audience I'm talking to now that I would call it cardinal Christian virtue of love is really uppermost. And it's something that we should think about, we should have at hand as a guide to all of our actions. Admitting that we're not, you know, as soon as we become engaged in life, we're going to lapse. We are particular beings. We're going to fail. But we pick ourselves up and go back to that. And I do think we are bigger and better people at the same time.
Gary Wright, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Well, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I am Nathan Gilmore saying, Go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.